Attention Idaho and California residents. If you're shopping for a mortgage, contact PacFi, a mortgage brokerage with the top wholesale lenders in the nation. They are committed to simplifying the mortgage process, saving you time and money. Call 858-442-7048 or visit pacfi.com. NMLS number 1462943, Equal Housing Lender. Welcome to the Alcohol Tipping Point podcast. I'm your host, Debbie Mazner, registered nurse, health coach, and alcohol-free badass. And I'm super excited to have on the podcast today addiction specialist and licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Jennifer Fernandez. Welcome, Dr. Fernandez.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about who you are and what you do.
Sure. So as you said, I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I've been licensed since 2014, and I have a practice in San Francisco, California, that focuses on harm reduction psychotherapy for people who use drugs and for their loved ones. So we also work with partners, parents, families, and we have a group practice going. So there's also some training that we're doing for new clinicians who are interested in providing harm reduction as a form of substance use disorder treatment. And over the years, I've also, I'm really passionate about drug education, so I've also come up with some other resources. My partner is an artist and makes different interactive LED artwork, and so we made this really fun suitcase called the Flight Attendant that's based off of TripSit's drug combination chart. So we bring that with us to parties where we know folks are going to be using substances recreationally. And so it's a fun, interactive, educational toy that they can play with to learn more about safer substance use. I wrote a workbook in 2018 on harm reduction and substance use management, published an online course last year. And so, I'm always just kind of thinking about resources and different ways to access those resources, specifically for harm reduction and drug education, to help people just make better choices about their relationship with drugs or alcohol.
And what is harm reduction?
That's a very big question. So harm reduction is kind of like a philosophy, I would say. And from this understanding, there, branches out into many different realms, many different ways that harm reduction can be practiced. So harm reduction, I think, as a philosophy, is this very pragmatic, person-centered, compassionate approach to substance use. So we just accept that adults want to alter their consciousness and that humans have been doing that since recorded history. And that, fulfills many different intentions and purposes. And so we work with people where they're at with their substance use or misuse. And we really focus on practical, loving resources and interventions to help them have the safest possible relationship and experience with those substances. So that can take on drug policy, right? Like Students for Sensible Drug Policy is a harm reduction organization, the Harm Reduction Coalition, which does drug policy and drug use education. That can take on public health models, which began in I think it was the 70s in Holland, when a bunch of people who use drugs intravenously came together to form a union, a drug users union, and really demanded from the government that they had access to clean needles, you know, safer supplies, a safer drug supply, wound care, access to mental health care, access to medical care. So it can be adopted as a public health approach for people who use drugs. And then in around 2000, that evolved to include psychotherapy. So one of my mentors, Dr. Pat Denning and Dr. Andrew Tatarsky, who's based in New York, they wrote books about harm reduction psychotherapy based on motivational interviewing and Dr. Ellen Marlatt's work with people who use alcohol, and formed this new way of, or this new form of addiction treatment called harm reduction psychotherapy, which again, same philosophy, pragmatic, client-centered, compassionate, we meet you where you're at. And we utilize a lot of like motivational interviewing techniques in addition to a bunch of other interventions to help people just become really intentional about their use. And that can include moderation, that can include abstinence, that can include not knowing and being really ambivalent about what type of relationship you want to have with substances. But the idea is that we're gonna work with you wherever you're at and help you get clear on what type of relationship you want to have.
Yeah, and so definitely a different approach than a lot of other addiction approaches where it's abstinent based.
That's right.
Who would this be good for?
Well, harm reduction. So I think I want to be clear that abstinence is harm reduction, because I think sometimes there can be this like a false dichotomy that's created. And so the way I talk about it and that other folks in the movement talk about it is, you know, that abstinence is the best form of harm reduction, right? Like that is a really great way to reduce risks associated with substance use. But we say also that, you know, there's room for other ways of being in relationship with substances. But to answer your question, so from a harm reduction psychotherapy perspective, it's a really great modality for folks who are really ambivalent about changing their relationship with substances, folks for whom abstinence hasn't worked, and so they're in a cycle of chronic relapse. Sometimes coming in with a harm reduction approach either helps them learn that they are good candidates for moderation, or it helps them learn that they're really not good candidates for moderation, and is a more gentle and client-centered way to achieve abstinence. So folks who are, really ambivalent, folks who are having a hard time with abstinence-based approaches, and, you know, I think just anyone else who's open to thinking about their relationship with substances and what needs are being fulfilled by that relationship. So it's also a dual diagnosis modality. So we really work with folks to help them see not just the relationship and attachment that they formed, but more from like a self-medication perspective, how the addiction itself or the problematic substance use is really a symptom of a larger underlying issue. And so we really work with the person to help them identify what that is and address that. So sometimes when someone comes to harm reduction therapy, that's all we're working on. They might come in and say, you know what, I don't want to talk about my alcohol use. I don't want to think about my alcohol use. I just want to focus on this other stuff that's not working in my life. We'll say, okay, no problem. Let's focus on the anxiety, the depression, trauma. Maybe you're having relationship issues. Let's look at that stuff and help you feel like, you know, you have more agency there. You're feeling more empowered there. And generally what tends to happen is that that affects their relationship with alcohol in a positive way, because we're reducing triggers, we're reducing stressors, we're reducing reasons for them to misuse alcohol, for example.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a more, you know, patient-centered approach and just respectful of that person that you're treating.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and we really respect folks, I would say wisdom, you know, that I am an addiction specialist and an expert in addiction because I have all this training and schooling and certifications and all this stuff, but it's really the person's lived experience that matters and carries the most weight. And so while I may have lots of ideas and interventions and skills to help you, you know, change this behavior, ultimately, you know what's going to work best for you and at what pace, on what timeline. So I'm really leading by following, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so the patient is really the one who's directing the treatment. And I'm just there as kind of like a cheerleader for one, a reminder of their self-worth, because there's so much shame and stigma embedded not just in addiction, but also in the way that we talk about addiction and in the way that we talk about people who use drugs and alcohol. So I'm actively trying to undo all of that internalized shame and stigma. And then, you know, just kind of throwing ideas at the problem. Do you think this would work? Do you think that would work? And reflecting back to the person to help keep them motivated. You know, something that comes up a lot is someone will come in and say, I drank too much one day this week, you know, and I'll say, okay, well, let's definitely look at that and see what happened. But what happened the other 6 days that you didn't overdrink? What did you do then? What were those days like? So really helping them to shift their mindset and their perspective too about how much work they're already doing, how much, you know, success they're already having. Because again, I think that the shame and the stigma can really affect that filter from which they're seeing the behavior.
Absolutely. What do you, you know, speaking of addiction, like, what is it that we get wrong about addiction? And by we, I mean like society.
Oh man, another big question. Where to start? I think addiction is a really complicated phenomenon. You know, I think that here in the United States, we talk about it as a brain disease, right? And I think that's just one facet of what's going on. I really like this idea of addiction as a biopsychosocial phenomenon. And it's not just what happens in a person's brain when they consume a substance for the first time or for the 100th time. That there's also a large component of their psychological functioning, their role in society, and whether or not they are subject to systems of oppression. And embedded in the psychology of the addiction is, you know, like I've been talking a lot about relationship, and I use that term very like literally, you know, that there's an attachment that forms to the substance over time. And it can be an attempt to kind of like remaster our traumas if we've had unhealthy or just a disrupted attachment in the past. So there's a lot to untangle in all of those facets. So it's complicated. I think we're still learning a lot about it. And I think the thing that we get wrong the most, unfortunately, is the idea that it's some kind of moral issue, that a person with an addiction is a certain type of person. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a liar, they can't be trusted, they're weak, they're, you know, insert any number of stigmas here. They're a particular gender, they're a particular race, they're a particular ethnic group, they come from a specific socioeconomic status. So just all these ideas about who becomes a person who struggles with addiction and who doesn't, you know, the type of drug that they use. So there's so much misinformation to correct. I think a better way to say that is like, there's so much education that we can that we can provide to people about substances and about addiction. And I really think that education can be the most effective way of preventing addiction. And if we really talked about, like, okay, this is what's really happening in your brain when you smoke cannabis. This is what's happening in your brain if you're under 25. This is what's happening in your brain if you're over 25. If you're under 25, you really shouldn't use cannabis. But if you are going to, then here's how to do it in a way to minimize as much harm as possible. If you are smoking cannabis or using cannabis, like, here are the signs that actually it might be getting out of control for you, and you need to, you should consider getting some help, some professional help, instead of the drug education that we have now, which is just abstinence, zero tolerance, I think that if we actually talked with kids and adults about why we use substances and how to use substances with less risk, that we could actually prevent a good amount of addiction.
And what does the research show for the harm reduction approach in reducing use?
It's very effective at reducing use because that's kind of our main goal. So every research project out there is focused on reducing use. So it's different from abstinence-based research where you're looking at a complete, you're looking at zero use. So I'm trying to think of the stats. It's been a long time. So since I wrote my dissertation, I haven't really been looking up research studies specific to harm reduction in this realm. I can speak anecdotally that in my practice, So in my practice, I would say, a lot of folks, 80 to 90% of folks are able to reduce their use to, less than what they came in using. And in terms of really meeting their goals and feeling like they are able to have a healthy relationship, whatever the outcome is, whether they've decided to abstain or they've been able to achieve healthy moderation, I would say that's probably a little bit lower. That's maybe like the 60 to 70%. So we're definitely getting folks to use less. We're definitely getting folks to use more safely. So let's say I have someone who's coming in and they're injecting a substance, most of the time I can get that person to, insufflate or snort that substance instead. So there's a safer route of administration, right? Mm-hmm. And then the rates anecdotally, again, for that person really being able to develop a healthy relationship with the substance where it no longer meets criteria for addiction or for substance use disorder, and they really have been able to achieve like a sense of empowerment around their use, that's more under like 60 to 70%. I'm not aware that that kind of data exists.
It's I think hard
the data
to measure.
Is mostly around, it's hard to measure. Yeah. I think the data exists around like quantity. How much mm-hmm. is this person using? Are they using less? And routes of administration. I think that data is out there. And particularly for alcohol, Ellen Marlatt did a lot of that research. And I'm not sure who might be doing it now. That's a good question.
Well, in regards to alcohol and harm reduction, what are your top tips for anyone looking to change their relationship with alcohol?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the first thing is just to assess safety. So if a person is drinking a lot and they have a physical dependence to alcohol, so, they're waking up with shakes, they start to feel disoriented when they stop drinking, they're having hallucinations when they stop drinking, that person is not a good candidate for abstinence, like cold turkey abstinence. So they would have to go to a medical detox or something like that or work very closely with a physician to slowly titrate off of alcohol. And usually, they give you other medications to help control for the sudden drop in what's, GABA in your brain. So there's a risk of seizure. There's even a risk of death from stopping cold turkey that level of severe alcohol use. So that would be the first thing to assess. Do you have any of the signs of physical dependency? And if you do, you got to connect with a medical provider. The second thing would be, you know, there are a lot of great resources out there. There's a responsible drinking workbook that I really like. That's the name of it, Responsible Drinking. And then there's also a Harm Reduction Management, HAM, network. That's Kenneth Anderson. He's got a great workbook, How to Change Your Drinking. And so those are both based on moderation. So how to reduce by delaying your drinking, watering your alcohol down. So if you usually drink wine, can you make it a spritzer? If you're drinking really high ABV alcohol, can you bring the alcohol content down by drinking, you know, like a Pilsner instead of an IPA or something like that? You know, making sure that you are counting your drinks, that can be really helpful. And having that kind of like a tracking system is really helpful. If you're wanting to reduce, you can set weekly goals for yourself. What are some of the other things that we'll work on? You know, the big thing is just kind of anticipating triggers in high risk situations and how, you know, creating a moderation plan for how you want to navigate that. So the holidays coming up, right, are a huge trigger. So with my clients, I talk a lot about showing up late to events, leaving early, really delaying their drinking. So don't start drinking right away. Let yourself have a half hour or an hour where you're really able to connect, mingle before you start drinking. And you can use that time to assess, like, how activated am I in this space? How triggered am I feeling? And if I'm feeling really, really triggered, knowing that that's a high-risk situation for overusing or, you know, for using in a way that's not aligned with values. So again, really trying to like understand the relationship with all of these factors, and how that impacts your desire to drink. Other kind of practical things would be, you know, we talk a lot about naltrexone for folks who are drinking a lot and for whom the moderation is a little bit more challenging to achieve strictly through a behavioral method. So naltrexone is a medication that you can get from a psychiatrist or from your doctor. So what folks say to me is that it makes drinking like slightly less interesting. You know, like they can have that first drink and then that second one is not as enticing as it usually is, you know? So some folks will take naltrexone and then still drink. That's called the Sinclair method. And then some folks will take naltrexone just to help them manage urges to drink, and they practice abstinence while they're taking the naltrexone. So you could talk to your prescriber about which of those methods would work best for you given your situation. Maybe you can ask me more questions about it, about other tips, because now I'm drawing a blank.
Oh, well, those are great. I just think that meeting people where they are is so key, because for some people, you know, they know that their drinking's out of control and they need to make a change, but changing forever, that is so daunting, and it's so it. Feels yeah. It has felt like, I should say, you either that you don't really have a choice, even though we do, but it has felt like, well, I either need to completely abstain or I need to somehow quote unquote become a normal drinker, but I haven't found out how to be a normal drinker and there's no treatment to help me be a normal drinker, so what do I do? So it's great to have these resources available to be safer, like you said, and just help with the shame, because there really is so much shame when you know that something's causing a problem in your life, but you're, for whatever reason, having a hard time controlling it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's true that not everyone is able to be a normal drinker. And, you know, there may be many reasons for that. There may be like a dopamine sensitivity that a person has that just makes substance use much more challenging to manage. There may be too long of a history, too long of a relationship with the substance that makes that kind of sustainable change, again, just too challenging, right? And so then when we confront that in therapy, either this, you know, I'm not going to be able to change this relationship, I'm going to have to abstain, or even, you know what, I can be a normal drinker, but sometimes I really miss partying hard, you know, there's like a grief process that needs to happen there. And I think that's something that we don't talk about enough in the addiction treatment world. Again, if we think about this as a relationship, even if, like, sometimes I ask my clients, like, what kind of partner is alcohol to you? Like, when are they there for you? Wow. How do they make you feel better? You know, how do they make things worse? You know, and then sometimes through that process and that understanding, they recognize, like, yeah, my relationship with alcohol is kind of like being in relationship with an abusive partner. And sure, there are good aspects to it, but, you know, like, the cost really outweighs the benefits. And so we have to think about breaking up and the grief process inherent in that, right? In ending a relationship that may have started off really well and may have started off by really helping us meet some important needs. Right? Like that, this is the idea behind self-medication hypothesis, that we're using substances because it is helping us achieve something. There are likely better tools for us to achieve those needs, but that may be the best tool that we have at our disposal at the time. And then over time, it just becomes harder and harder to change those associations and to break that habit. But, you know, if you've been using alcohol for a really long time and it's something that helps you manage your depression or your anxiety, you know, stopping forever may seem like, what do you mean? Like, you're just going to pull the only tool that I have away from me, and then what? What am I supposed to do with everything that's left over inside? You know, so I do think that this, you know, meeting people where they're at, helping them understand how this relationship developed, and then giving them just more compelling tools is ultimately more effective than just saying, yeah, you got to stop forever. You have no other option.
I really resonate with that. I even sometimes, instead of saying like I was done, like I will say like I got a divorce
yeah.
from alcohol. And I mean, same thing where I kind of kept going back to it, even though yeah. I knew it wasn't good for me. It took me a while to be like, yeah, we done. Like, we're done.
Yeah, sometimes you have to go back for like a rebound, and then you're like, no, yes. Wait, I really am done.
Yeah.
That's totally normal. Yeah.
What about when people get to the point where they really are done? And they want to be done. They get like 14 days under their belt, but then they drink again. Mm-hmm. And then they're like in that shame spiral again. Like, what advice do you have for that person?
Mm-hmm. So it's totally normal. And I think it's important to plan for those kinds of relapses, because again, this is a relationship that you've likely had for a very long time, and it's very compelling. It's compelling on a biological level, and it's compelling on a psycho-emotional level. And so I would say use the relapse as an opportunity to learn about your needs or your boundaries or your values. So can you go back to the drawing board and figure out, okay, what was going on for me there? What was I feeling? What was I needing that I didn't get? And then try to address that in a way that's more sustainable, that feels healthier, that you feel empowered. Again, that's kind of based on your values. That really helps you honor who you are, and who you want to be in the world. So, you know, we spend a lot of time with folks reframing the idea of relapse as a failure and more as an opportunity for learning about ourselves.
Yeah.
And we also normalize it as part of the change process. right? If we look at any other behavioral change that's not related to addiction, relapse is part of it.
I think that normalizing it is so helpful. I think, well, what do you think of some other treatment modalities like AA, where it is you're counting days, you go back to day one if you've relapsed? Like, what are your thoughts on that, if you care to share?
Sure. Yeah, I think if that works for you, then I'm all for it. You know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with AA as long as you are feeling empowered by that process or by that program, and you're getting the support that you need from that program. I think if at any time it feels shaming or stigmatizing, then you have to kind of think for yourself, like, okay, can I leave that aspect of the program out for myself? Or is it just creating more reasons for me to use and relapse? Because shame is like the number one trigger for relapse. It's the most common reason for relapse that I encounter in my practice. So I think that's the question to ask yourself. You know, is this helpful for me? Is it helping me get the support that I need? Does it work for me enough? It's probably, I think for probably few people, it's 100% a perfect fit. But there are aspects of different treatment modalities or, you know, support systems that we can kind of let go of and still get a lot of benefit out of the rest, right?
Yes, definitely.
So I think that's what you want to look out for. I know that for some of the folks that I work with, having to start at day one again after a relapse would be incredibly, it would just be disappointing on such a deep level that it would suck all the motivation out of their process. But I have other folks who are just like, yeah, that's great. That's super motivating for me. Like, the more gamified, the better.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, I'm shooting for 100. I'm shooting for 1,000. I'm shooting for 10. You know, like, that really works for them. And so that's great.
The gamification, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the other thing about addiction. You know, you asked me earlier what don't we know about it? You know, each recovery journey is so different. It's completely individual and unique for each person. So what works for one person, you know, is not going to work for the next. And so we really have to be creative. We have to be flexible. We have to be compassionate. And we have to convey that to the folks that we work with to let them know, like, hey, whatever works for you, works for you. And what works today may not work for you next year.
Yeah.
So let's just keep working on it and thinking about it together and going back to the drawing board when we need to.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think we're so fascinating, and I think our brain is amazing, and just the amount of new information we have about our brain in the last, what has it been, like 20, 25 years? Amazing.
And we have like haven't even scratched the surface.
Yeah,
we still don't know what the heck's going on in there most of the time.
How did
from a neuroscience perspective,
right? How did you decide to go into this work?
It just really chose me. You know, I was really interested in neuroscience and psychology in like high school and early college. And then kind of along the course of starting pre-med and all that, I decided, I don't know, I really like my psychology classes a lot. I think I'm just going to do psychology. And once I was in my PhD program, you know, you have to do practicum hours. So you have to get practice hours to get licensed. And I just saw this harm reduction therapy center in San Francisco. And I was like, sure, I'll interview there. You know, like, sounds interesting. It's, you know, addiction is an interesting mix between the neuroscience aspect of addiction and then the relational work that happens in therapy. And when I interviewed there, I just immediately felt like I found my people. I was like, oh my gosh, this makes total sense. the way that you talk about substance use and addiction and why people use substances and how most people are able to use substances responsibly totally resonated with my experience and the way that I saw people around me using substances. And I really appreciated the compassionate approach. So I ended up doing 3 years of training there instead of the one and wrote my dissertation on harm reduction. I just really feel like it chose me. I had no idea it even existed before I applied to that.
Wow.
So that practical placement. Yeah.
That's great. Tell me about Power Over Addiction, your course.
Yeah, so the course is based on a workbook with the same name, Power Over Addiction. And I just found that in my practice with folks, we were kind of going over the same skill sets over and over again. Using some CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, a lot of skills and techniques from those modalities to help a person gain just kind of like the foundation of understanding about how addiction works so that then they could implement these skills to start changing their behavior. So the workbook and the course focus on a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about, so like evaluating your use and your relationship to substances, starting to identify the needs that are being met so that you can go outside of that relationship with substances to get those needs met in better ways. Practical skills like, cognitive reframing, emotional regulation, so how to change your thinking to help you be more successful at changing your relationship with substances, helping you learn how to tolerate feelings, which again is like a big trigger for folks. A lot of the people that I work with just have a hard time knowing either what they're feeling or what to do about what they're feeling. So the course and the workbook focus on that quite a bit. And then practical behavioral regulation skills. So what to actually do to start interrupting the behavior and changing it incrementally, right? It's a slow, gradual process. And in the book, I tie in some values work, some self-compassion, or in the course as well, values work, self-compassion work, and like a lifestyle inventory, really help you think about where your needs are being met and where they're not being met in your lifestyle. So that again, if you can really work on that and tweak that so that it's functioning in a way that's satisfying more of what you need and honoring more of your boundaries, then the relationship or the problematic relationship with the substance just becomes less compelling over time.
So much of the resources and tools and addiction use or addiction treatment in general are just such like great life skills.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, everyone right. should be taught about their emotions and managing yeah. them and, and
yeah,
stress reduction. And we should be teaching this to our high schoolers.
Oh, man. Elementary school. Like, let's start
yes.
even earlier.
Yes. I mean, I do think they're trying, right? Babies.
I think they're trying. Yeah. Yeah,
I think it's getting better. I'm thinking about my kids in elementary school. There was a big focus on, now I can't think. Total brain fart. But they are talking more about like intrinsic learning and being like a growth mindset. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Learning
yeah.
opportunities, that kind of thing. Effort, praising Good. Effort. And I think a lot of that can be applied to this as well. You know, one of the things I focus on when I am, talking to someone about quitting drinking, because that's what I focus on is the alcohol use, but it's just like practice, just practice not drinking.
It's practice.
You don't have to be perfect.
That's right. Well, there is no perfection anywhere, but especially here.
Yes.
Not, that's just the setup for failure, you know? Yeah. I mean, the folks that I've come in, there have been like a couple in my, you know, when did I start practicing harm reduction? 2009. So over a decade of doing this work, there have been a couple of people who come in and they're like, I'm not going to drink anymore, or I'm not going to use anymore. And then they don't. And they don't have any relapses, and they don't. And I'm like, I don't know how you're doing this.
I know. They're unicorns.
But they're the exception to the, yeah, they're unicorns. They are the exception to the rule.
Yeah.
So that is not a realistic expectation to have, you know, and I think it's really important to normalize that from the onset to say, you know, that's okay. Like, we're going to use those times as opportunities to learn about what we could be doing differently. Mm-hmm.
Well, gosh, what are your plans for the future?
My plans for the future. Oh, man. Right now, I'm really focused on just getting more harm reduction therapists out there. So really focused on training folks, expanding the private practice. I did just have the workbook translated into Spanish, and have been working with some folks over at UC Berkeley to bring more harm reduction psychotherapy to South America. So I also speak Spanish and provide therapy in Spanish. So I've been training some therapists down there on harm reduction because they've just had abstinence-based treatment for, you know, just like us forever. Mm-hmm. So that's been super interesting to work with a group of therapists for whom this is just paradigm shifting.
It right? is, like, isn't it? It is paradigm
shifting. This
idea
that yeah, humans use drugs for reasons. And most of the time, I mean, you know, you can look at the SAMHSA data. Most of the time, most folks don't have problems with their substance use. You know, it is the minority of folks who end up developing some kind of addiction. And that's so not the narrative out there, right? Mm-hmm. The narrative is you're going to smoke pot once and get hooked on heroin, or, you know, that's, I'm exaggerating, but that's kind of what I internalized from the DARE program, you know, was that that marijuana was a gate way drug, and if I ever tried it, like, that was just gonna ruin my future forever. But then in middle school, like, all these kids were smoking pot, and I'm like, they seem fine. So, you know, what happened for me was, like, I just threw all of it out, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't believe anything that any adult had to say to me about drugs. Never trusted them because I thought they were just fear-mongering me. And I think, unfortunately, that's what happened. But back to your question, I think, really excited about getting more resources out in Spanish, as there's little knowledge of harm reduction in Central, in some parts of Central and South America, not all. I think just kind of waiting to see what folks are needing. So I really like to respond to what, you know, my clients or, you know, folks who follow my accounts on social media, sometimes they reach out and have feedback about, like, hey, do you know about any resources on this or on that? And so that kind of motivates me to create more content or, you know, think about other projects that I want to work on.
Yeah. Well, how can someone find you?
So I'm on Instagram. My handle there is at Power Over Addiction.
Love that title, by the way.
Thanks. It's a little controversial.
Is it? How is that controversial?
I think I've gotten that feedback from some folks who think, you know, that there's sort of this need to accept powerlessness.
Yeah, I guess that over, is one of the AA mm-hmm. tenets.
Yeah, Which, you know, if we're talking about it on a very philosophical level, power is a construct. It's not a real thing. We don't have power over anything. And ultimately, we can live a life of less suffering if we accept that we are powerless over everything. And I do believe that. I think that's really freaking hard to achieve.
Yeah, that sounds like climbing the mountain, becoming a monk, total acceptance. Interesting. Okay.
Yes.
But so, power over addiction.
Monks are like really good at that. But I think it's a good, you know, it's a good destination to strive towards, you know. But I think when I was writing the workbook, again, I'm just really interested in helping people feel motivated and helping them feel empowered and helping them have agency and like just breaking all of these ideas and stigmas that we have about addiction. So that title just really resonated for me as a way to kind of engage people in this process, which is very, you know, it's really based on helping you feel like a powerful agent of change over the thing that you otherwise feel out of control with. So, so yeah, poweroveraddiction.com has my educational resources on it, the course, the book, and then links to other harm reduction, and not necessarily harm reduction, but at least abstinence-based resources that are still practicing the philosophy of compassion and meeting folks where they're at. So, you know, groups like Smart Recovery, which I'm sure you've shared with folks before.
Yes.
Refuge Recovery, you know, all of these other alternatives to AA, because that's the other thing. People think AA is the only way to recover from addiction, but, you know, it's good to know that there are lots of different options out there.
Yeah.
You know, resources on CRAFT, which is an alternative to Al-Anon for friends and family and partners. And then my psychotherapy practice website is just my name, Jennifer Fernandez. PhD.com. So those are the three ways to get in touch with me, depending on why you might want to get in touch.
Well, great. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much for inviting me.
Yes. I think this is helpful, and I appreciate what you're doing, and look forward to seeing what else you'll be putting out into the world.
Thanks. Yeah, we'll see what the future brings.
Okay. Well, we will keep in touch. Have a wonderful day.
All right. Thanks so much, Debbie. Take care.
You too. Bye. Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Alcohol Tipping Point. I'm always here for you guys, so please feel free to reach out and talk to me on Instagram at Alcohol Tipping Point. And check out my website, alcoholtippingpoint.com. Again, I hope you can use these tips we talked about for the rest of your week. And until then, see you next time.